listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, May 8th. I'm Lauren from Drake University. Here is our first story. Nearly 25,000 more Iowans filed unemployment claims. Nearly 25,000 Iowans filed unemployment claims last week as the shutdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic continues to ravage the state's economy. Iowa Workforce Development reported 24,693 new claims, which includes 22,830 claims by Iowa residents who work in the state, of 1,863 claims by individuals who work in the state and live elsewhere. The new report comes as the state begins to allow the reopening of businesses that have been closed to limit the spread of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Governor Kim Reynolds first imposed business restrictions on March 17th. Since then, 285,422 jobless claims have been filed. There are 396 new claims in Pottawatomie County, along with 45 claims in Harrison County and 52 in Miles County for the week ending May 2nd, according to Iowa Workforce Development. There are 3,690 ongoing claims in Pottawatomie County, 323 in Harrison County, and 303 in Mills County. Nationally, nearly 3.2 million laid-off workers applied for unemployment benefits last week as the business shutdowns deepened the worst U.S. economic catastrophe in decades. Roughly 33.5 million people have now filed for jobless aid in the 7 weeks since the coronavirus began. This is the equivalent of one in five Americans who had been unemployed back in February, when the unemployment rate had reached a 50-year low of just 3.5%. National Nurses Week: how a local hospice nurse found meaning her work. National Nurses Week began Wednesday. In honor of the special week, Megan Brockus, a registered nurse case worker at the St. Croix Hospice in Council Bluffs, detailed the challenges of working on the front lines of healthcare and caring for hospice patients during COVID-19. St. Croix Hospice has started a standard that all healthcare staff has to wear gloves, masks, and face shields. With home patients and in the nursing home, Brockhaus said, "For every patient, I'm applying new equipment. We're taking extra precautions in cleaning our equipment as well. Nurses are steps up and taking on additional work to make patients comfortable despite limitations and restrictions. Nurses have been the only staff allowed in the facility at this time," Brockhaus said. "We're making the proper adjustments to make patients comfortable and provide extra support physically, mentally, and emotionally," she said. "It's been a challenge for sure, but I've been able to connect a lot more than with my patients." During the pandemic, patients have been able to see family or other staff such as chaplains or social workers. Even though the work and caring for these patients has increased, Brockhaus said she loves her job working with hospice patients. Before working for St. Croix, Brockhaus was a night nurse at Nebraska Medical Center. After her grandmother was taken into hospice, she learned from aunts, uncles, and parents about all the services hospice provided. After a while, she said, it all clicked, and pursued a career at St. Croix Hospice. "I wanted something that had meaning and I could relate to," I thought. "Hospice was perfect because they were caring for my grandma and I knew that's what I wanted to do," Brockhaus said. Working at night, Brockhaus said she didn't get to interact with patients or family members as often as she'd like. Now working in hospice care, she interacts with family and educates them daily, supporting the patient both emotionally and physically. Two patients have made a particular in her life since beginning her employment at the facility under a year ago. Brockhaus was speaking with the family, giving an overview of hospice care. After one visit, the patient died and the conversations about hospice were cut short. However, Brockhaus learned the impact of her meeting with the family by coincidence. Brockhaus said her co-worker was talking to a mother at a volleyball game. The mother praised the nurse who helped them with the relative in hospice care. Coincidentally, they were relatives of the patient Brockhaus cared for. "I said, oh my gosh, I was there for one visit," she said. "To know I could make an impact that way in their lives after one visit, I knew that's what I wanted to do forever." Another instance that solidified Brockhaus's job choice involved a patient who loved music. At a younger age, the patient had an opportunity to record music but chose to spend time with family. Instead, once in hospice, a friend of the patient collected money to record the patient's songs and create music videos. Unfortunately, the patient passed away before they got the album done, but he listened to a couple of songs, Brockhaus said. Between the music and the talks she had with the patient, he was a person she'd never forget. Since these initial solidifying experiences, Brockes said she worked with families and patients who have expressed gratitude for her profession. That type of impact is part of why Brockes loves being a hospice nurse. I love my job. It's been amazing, she said. I didn't know how good of an impact I could make. State County Parks to reopen with restrictions on Friday by Mike Brownlee. Campgrounds across the state and locally will reopen today with restrictions. Pottawatomie County Conservation said Thursday campgrounds at Arrowhead Park in Neola, Botana Bend Park in Hancock, and Hitchcock Nature Center in Honey Creek will reopen at 6 a.m. today on a first-come, first-served basis. The campgrounds are available only to campers with self-contained restroom units. All pit latrines, modern restrooms, shower houses, and playgrounds will remain closed, the conservation department said. The department said park visitors and campers are expected to maintain proper physical distancing, at least 6 feet of separation, and proper hygiene. In keeping with group size restrictions, campsites are too occupied by the tenants of that site only at all times, and no more than 10 people are to occupy a site at a time, officials said in a release. Some sites may be closed to ensure proper physical distancing. Backpack campsites will reopen at Hitchcock on Monday. The move comes after a proclamation by Governor Kim Reynolds. The county said site reservations and firewood sales will be handled with physical distancing and limited personal contact. Campers are asked to self-register at a kiosk at each park, and firewood sales will be available but with proper physical distancing. There will be no canoe or paddle boat rentals, cabin reservations, or concessions offered at any of the parks. All conservation department buildings will remain closed. Parks, wildlife areas, and trails remain open and will remain open in the county, so as long as visitors are able to maintain proper physical distancing, the conservation department said. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources will open state campgrounds at 8 a.m. today, also limiting grounds to campers with self-contained restrooms. The department defines self-contained as a tent or pop-up camper with a portable toilet or an RV with a functioning self-contained bed. Walk-in campers may begin registering at 8 a.m. Today to Sunday, walk-in only, first-come, first-served basis. Monday, May 11th, reservations will go into effect. The DNR's campground reservation system will begin accepting reservations starting at 9 a.m. on Friday. All other reservations will continue as served beginning May 15th, unless otherwise notified directly by DNR. The department extended an apology to those who had reservations scheduled during the May 8th to May 14th time period. Those reservations will not be honored because refunds have already been issued and the transactions are complete, the department said. The department said there was an influx of visitors to state parks and expects to see the same at campgrounds. Park staff will be closely monitoring these areas to avoid gatherings of groups larger than 10. Staff presence throughout the park and campgrounds will remain and educate visitors to continue physical distancing while enjoying some of Iowa's most beautiful public places. Campers should also abide by the following guidelines. Visitors will not be allowed to in the campgrounds, only those occupying the campsites. Campfires at the individual campsites will be limited to campers occupying the campsite. 6 occupants per campsite unless immediate family contains more than 6. Some pit latrines are now open in busier day use areas. All modern restrooms and shower buildings, including water fountains, remain closed. Communal picnic pantries and grills are open for use at your own risk. Playgrounds, day use rental lodges, and shelter houses will remain closed. Cabins, yurts, and shelter houses will remain closed. Visitor centers, nature centers, and museums within state parks will remain closed. Beaches remain open, but will be monitored closely. Some campgrounds may be closed due to construction or maintenance issues, so please check the specific closure information below for each park before planning a camping trip. The DNR and county conservation recommend practicing physical distancing so that the parks and campgrounds remain open as a visible option for recreational opportunity. Campers should assume personal responsibility and abide by the guidelines set forth. Iowa has 68 state parks and 4 state forests. For more information regarding Pottawatomie County Conservation Campgrounds, Parks, and Facilities, call 712-328-5638 or email mark.shoemaker at pottcounty-ia.gov. Information is also available online at pottacoconservation.com or on Pottawatomi County Conservation's Facebook pages. Go to iowadnr.gov for information on state parks. Pottawatomi County reopens, reports 3 new COVID-19 cases, bringing county total to 72. By Mike Brownlee. Pottawatomi County reported 3 new cases of COVID-19 on Thursday, 2 Council Bluffs residents and an Oakland resident. There have been 72 confirmed cases in the county. Of those, 2 have died after contracting the disease caused by the coronavirus. 31 individuals have recovered, 38 are self-isolating at home, and 1 is hospitalized, according to Pottawatomi County Health. The individuals, a man and 2 women, connected to the 3 new cases. 3 new cases were tested for COVID-19 between May 4th and May 5th. One of the individuals has pre-existing conditions, and all 3 had contact with an existing case, the department said. All 3 are self-isolating at home. Pottawatomi County Public Health said it continues to conduct contact tracing investigations for each COVID-19 case, saying a part of contact tracing is assessing risk to the general public. If there is not a risk to the general public, public health will communicate directly with the specific contacts identified in the investigation. If and when a risk to the general public is identified, public health will publicly identify the location and communicate any actions the public should take, the department said in a release. There have been 838 tests conducted in Pottawatomi County. Mills County Public Health reported the county's 7th case, an adult between 41 and 60 years old who contracted the disease after contact with another positive case. 3 of the county's cases have recovered. I know there are concerns in the county about the increase in positive cases we are seeing, Mills County Public Health Administrator Julie Lyons said in a release. I want to assure Mills County residents that the increase we are seeing is related to the increase of COVID-19 testing and test availability. Elsewhere in Southwest Iowa, according to the state COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, and previous reports by countries, Harrison County has 17 cases, 173 tests. Shelby County, 13 cases, 116 cases. Montgomery County, 2 cases, 131 tests. Page County, 9 cases, 310 tests. Cass County, 1 case, 135 tests. Monona County, 11 cases, 133 tests. Crawford County, 124 cases, 1 death, 310 tests. The state website did not have recoveries broken down by county on Thursday. The site said it did not have data for Fremont County. Iowa reported 655 new cases on Thursday, bringing the state total to at least 11,059. There have been 231 deaths from the disease in the state. There have been 66,427 tests conducted in the state for a per capita rate of 1 in 46 Iowans. On the Iowa state's positive cases, 4,266 have recovered, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov, which has been revamped to provide more timely information. Gov Kim Reynolds said during a live stream press conference on Thursday that the numbers will now be as of 11:59 p.m. that previous day. The site had previously updated the numbers as of 10 a.m. the previous day. Reynolds didn't open her daily news briefing Thursday with the updated numbers. She said the state's focus is managing the virus. I do think we're shifting in the way that we're talking about the virus and how we maintain it, she said. Since we kind of really accomplished what we were trying to do to make sure that we had the health care resources available, we now have shifted our focus from mitigation of resources to managing and containing virus activity as we begin to open Iowa back up. The state has been criticized for failing to squash outbreaks among workers at meatpacking plants, but President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence complimented Reynolds for managing the situation. Unions and other advocates for the plant workers, many of whom are immigrants, have complained their victims of corporations refusing to act swiftly enough to protect them as they stand side by side cutting up pork, chicken, and beef. State officials announced Tuesday that nearly 1,400 workers at 3 Tyson Foods pork processing plants in Iowa have tested positive for the virus. In recent days, several meat plants have closed due to outbreaks, most for just days to allow crews to clean and sanitize the plants. Reynolds called the production of meat in Iowa a finely oiled machine, and we have to make sure all aspects of it are working appropriately. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, who also attended the White House meeting Wednesday, and meatpacking plants should be packed in production within 10 days. High worker absenteeism due to sickness and fear of infection has reduced the capacity of plants to produce meat, causing some major retailers to limit consumer purchases and analysts to predict higher prices in the coming months. Dentists prepare to reopen after 2-month closure by Tim Johnson. Local dentists are hurrying to get ready for the new normal after Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday that dental clinics can resume offering elective services today. Previously, she had set the date at May 18th. Because of the need to prepare, none of the local clinics contacted by the Nonpareil Thursday plan to open today. Omni Dental Care, which opened its Omaha clinic last week, plans to open its Council Bluffs office and its Aesthetic and Family Dentistry office in Shenandoah on Monday, and Carter Lake and Oakland clinics on May 8th, according to John Lynch. Everything's being constantly wiped down and sanitized, he said. In addition, Omni staff has been trained on the new protocols and had an opportunity to talk to one of the providers or manager about their fears or concerns about reopening, Lynch said. Elsewhere, Broadway Family and Cosmetic Dentistry plan to reopen on May 18th. The Children's Dentistry and of Council Bluffs will have a soft opening during the next 2 weeks, said Carrie Jackson and Joe Quattarachi, respectively. That is just so we can have the office ready and have PPE and get appointments on the schedule in advance, Quattarachi said. Said Jackson, we just want to be sure we're all comfortable opening up before we actually open.
The clinics must have plenty of personal protective equipment on hand and follow new guidelines adopted Tuesday by the Iowa Dental Board to minimize the chances of patients or staff being exposed to the coronavirus. Under the guidelines, dental health care practitioners must be screened at the beginning of their shifts for fever and symptoms of COVID-19. Patients must be similarly screened before they receive services. Dental practitioners must wear a respirator or surgical mask and face shield while providing care, as well as gloves and a gown, the guidelines state. They must avoid certain procedures and the use of specific kinds of equipment that might produce aerosols, tiny droplets of moisture that can float into the air. At the Omni Dental Center, patients will be asked to wear a mask and do a curbside check-in, Lynch said. The patients are going to get a massage 30 minutes before their appointment. A message 30 minutes before their appointment, he said. When they arrive in the parking lot, they will push a button to indicate that they are there, Lynch said. Then a staff person will reply with the clinic and staff are ready for them to enter. They will be greeted at the door by a staff person in a mask, gown, and gloves who will take their temperature and ask if they have symptoms, have been exposed to anyone with COVID-19, and whether they have traveled outside the area. If a patient has previously had symptoms, they will be asked if they have been fever-free for at least 72 hours without using any fever reducers. We understand that we are indeed going to have people with COVID-19 come in, he said. If they pass the screening, patients will be asked to gargle a peroxide solution to kill contaminants in their mouth before they enter an exam room. After their appointment, patients will put their mask back on and exit through a side door, Lynch said. Omni has been offering emergency care for patients throughout the closure, he said. We have regularly scheduled emergency visits, Lynch said. The practice wanted to give patients the care they needed and also keep them out of emergency rooms so physicians could tend to more urgent cases and the patients were not exposed to coronavirus in that environment, he said. Children's dentistry wants patients to bring their own mask and parents to stay in their vehicles while their children enter the clinic for their appointments, Quattarachi said. Of course, the guidelines also call for increased cleaning and disinfecting. We always had a strict standard with cleanliness and infection control, but we're just going to take that to the next level, Jackson said. Forecast: areas of frost in the area overnight by Emily Scheibe. After a day of rain, today will be sunny with highs in the 50s. Tonight, the Council Bluffs Omaha area will see some frost, according to the National Weather Service and Valley
Nebraska. Lows will be in the 30s with a mild north wind. Areas of frost will continue into early Saturday morning before temperatures warm up to a high of 63. The forecast according to the Weather Service, today sunny with a high near 56 north wind around 14 miles per hour. Tonight areas of frost on after 5 a.m. otherwise mostly clear with a low around 36 northwest wind 5 to 9 miles per hour becoming calm in the evening. Saturday at 20% chance of showers after 1 p.m. Areas of frost before 7 a.m. otherwise partly sunny with a high near 63. Light south wind becoming southwest 5 to 10 p.m. 10 miles per hour. A 30% chance of showers before 1 a.m. mostly cloudy with a low around 39. New precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch possible. Mostly sunny with a high near 56. Sunday night mostly clear with low around 36. Monday partly sunny with a high near 56. Monday night a slight chance of showers after 1 a.m. mostly cloudy with a low around 41. Tuesday a chance of showers mostly cloudy with a high near 59. Tuesday night a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms mostly cloudy with a low of 46. Wednesday night a chance of showers and thunderstorms mostly cloudy with a high near 64. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, May 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Lauren from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-408-474. Editorial. Serology tests have no value in fight against COVID-19 pandemic without meaning, standards for quality, and accuracy. We are being bombarded by seemingly constant reminders that common sense, at least when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, is in as short a supply as a vaccine to guard against the coronavirus. On Monday, the Federal Food and Drug Administration under fire for allowing more than 100 commercial coronavirus antibody tests on the market without review moved to assert oversight, saying the tests will have to pass agency muster, including meeting standards for quality and accuracy. Thank you, it's certainly about time, actually well past time. In an effort to lessen the impact, officials said, unscrupulous actors have been marketing fraudulent test kits and using the pandemic as an opportunity to take advantage of Americans' anxiety. History, not just the history of this country, but the world is replete with unscrupulous actors who have used every malady, whether real or imagined, as an opportunity to take advantage of people's anxiety, to imagine that would not be the case with something as devastating as COVID-19 is, in our opinion, unimagined. This week's FDA action came after the agency was criticized, and rightly so, for a March 16 policy that allowed commercial test makers to sell antibody tests after validating their own data and notifying the FDA. The result, the Washington Post reported, based on the comments of testing experts, was a flood of productions and dubious quality that confused hospitals, doctors, and consumers. What Scott Becker, chief executive officer of the Association of Public Health Laboratories, terms a wild, wild west environment. The association which represents state and local public laboratories, urged the FDA to exert its authority over the test. Antibody or serology are a test designed to identify people who may have overcome COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, including those who had no symptoms and developed an immune response. They are not designed to detect active infections. Some officials tout the blood test as a way to identify people who have developed immunity and can safely return to work. At the time, many scientists say that even for a good test, evidence is lacking that the test can prove someone has immunity for the coronavirus or for how long. Experts warn that inaccurate tests can result in serious consequences. Incorrect results could indicate people have immunity against the virus when they don't, potentially resulting in behavior that would endanger them or those around them. Serology testing is one tool increasingly mentioned in strategies to end state and local mitigation efforts. The tests are also a way to determine whether people who have recovered from COVID-19 can donate blood that can be used to manufacture convalescent plasma that is being tried as a potent treatment. But serology tests have no value as a tool if they fail to meet standards for quality and accuracy. Obituaries. Wayne Joseph Joe Geese, 74, of Omaha, Nebraska, passed on May 5, 2020. Joe was born on August 15, 1945, in Sioux City, Iowa. He grew up in Laurel, Nebraska, under the loving care of Bill and Clara Betters. He served in the United States Navy for 23 years before retiring in Bellevue, Nebraska, with his wife Debbie. He is preceded in death by his parents and wife Debbie Hubler Geese. He is survived by his sons Dean Pam Geese of Macedonia, Iowa, Darren Geese of Boise, Idaho, and Jody Geese of Nebraska City, Nebraska. Their mother, Sharon Bartz of Omaha, numerous grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and a host of other families and friends, at his request, no chapel services or visitation will be held. Military honors will be presented at a brief graveside service at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 9th, 2020. The Bohemian Cemetery in Omaha. Should friends desire, contributions may be sent to Vet Help 1-1003 R Street, Omaha, Nebraska 68127. Sports. Lewis Central girls boys soccer programs had big aspirations for 2020 season. In a battle of resumes, who wins? In one corner is a program that has claimed three states of championship in the last 4 years, with the return of two Division I recruits. A fourth title in 5 years was the goal for what was supposed to be the 2020 season. In the other corner stands a program coming off its first state title in the program history. It features a senior class that has won 36 matches and 41 tries over the last 2 years and has scored 195 goals combined over the last 3 years while conceding only 29. A second consecutive championship was a realistic expectation for 2020. Meet the Lewis Central girls and boys soccer teams respectively. The Titans have new standards for success for both programs. The girls have qualified for four consecutive state tournaments. This spring, Iowa State recruit Grace Guidry and Drake recruit Bella Smith, both seniors, were expected to rejoin the roster after not playing for LC in 2019. They helped the Titans win state titles in both 2017 and 2018. That duo, plus an already deep roster featuring fellow seniors regulars Jaden Cross, Melena Beasley, Gracie Bernard, Rachel Cushing, Hadley Hill, and Caitlin Hanafan, had LC coach Chris Von Mendy thinking a fourth state championship trophy could soon be a reality. Having Bella and Grace there for this last year, I think we would have done very well, Von Mendy said. The depth level we have more depth than I've ever had. When you have that, it's just like everyone is a starter. There's no real drop off. Now with this class leaving, we're going to have some difficulty to match up to what that class brought us. We just may have to change some of our tactics as we go. An unfortunate possibility became the new reality in mid-April when spring sports were canceled. Von Mendy hurt for his players, especially the current senior class that played a large part in establishing the Titans' culture of perennial state success. Once you've got your kids and they understand the system of how we do things, they figure it out, Von Mendy said. They figure it out quicker than most, and they understand what they're supposed to do and where they're supposed to be. I know they're going to give everything. They're always ready to play and battle. While the Titan girls have established themselves as a state power, the LC boys soccer program is in the midst of a major rise. Third-year coach James Driver has led the Titans to a 36-5 record in his brief tenure, which included a state championship in June 2019. And considering what the class of 2020 has brought to the program, it's no surprise that it's hoisted that championship trophy. Over the last 3 years, the LC boys have claimed three Hawkeye 10 conference championships, three city championships, 10 all conference selections, 8 Daily Nonpareil All-City selections, 2 All-State selections, 51 wins, and 195 goals. 5 members of the senior class are expected to continue playing soccer in college, and that number could increase as decisions are made in the future. Those accomplishments are great, but to know that more accolades could have been added had been this spring season taking place is frustrating for Driver and his squad. Coming into the season, we had short-term goals, Driver said, being city champs, winning conference, things of that nature, smaller goals. But our ultimate goal this season that we kind of unexpected was giving ourselves a chance to getting back to the state championship. Not only making the state tournament, but making it to the championship game. We had the guys to do it. The guys were putting in all the work off season on their own to prepare to be the best soccer players they could be. Unfortunately, it got cut completely because of COVID. The senior class included regulars James Devine, Luis Espino, Cole Drummond, Connor Williams, Connor Lancio, Adam Mortensen, Jacob Lynn, Joey Valentine, Mason Vander Wode, and Zach McDaniel, among others. It was as deep as it was talented. We've raised the bar, Driver said. This group of guys raised the bar so high, and we've seen new heights with our program. Our expectations are still going to remain high. This class accomplished a lot. They worked hard on and off the field. Both Driver and Von Mendy know no compliments of or kind words can take away the pain of not knowing how the 2020 season might have played out. But both have stressed their players how they've played important roles in claiming a championship, which can never be taken away. And neither can the roles they played in building the foundation of the culture that is Lewis Central Soccer. The bright side of everything is that the last game they played, they won, and they won a state championship, something that Lewis Central has never done in history, on the Driver side. They accomplished a lot in their careers. I told them to look forward to the next step in their careers. The future is bright for Lewis Central Soccer for both boys and girls. There's excitement there. Area golf courses adjust to COVID-19 by Derek Noren. With temperatures warming up and cabin fever setting in for many golf courses provide an outlet for people to get outdoors and be active. However, like almost everything else, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the golf industry in the Council Bluffs area. While courses are still open, there are some distinct changes. In an effort to limit the spread of germs, many courses in Council Bluffs have changed their whole configuration. At Dodge Riverside and Fox Run, all cups are flipped over, while a bent tree, a 2-inch circular PVC pipe, has been placed in each cup. Shoreline in Carter Lake has inserted foam into their cups. All of these methods are in an effort to ensure golfers can remove their ball without it falling to the bottom of the hole, preventing golfers from having to touch the inside of the cup. At Fox Run, patrons can swipe their own cards for no-touch payment in general. Cleanliness has been ramped up, according to General Manager, Director of Golf, and part owner of Fox Run, Grant Wakefield. We sanitize our golf carts first thing in the morning after every use, Wakefield said. Everywhere that's touched, we're using top-of-the-line sanitizer, and our bathrooms are getting cleaned with bleach at least 2 to 4 times per day. Not that they weren't already, but we've really made a point of cleaning doorknobs and just anywhere that gets touched because of social distancing and shelter in place. Less people are out doing things. At the same time, people are itching to get outside even more. Favorable weather recently has only enhanced the according to Owen Schutz, general manager at Shoreline Golf Course in Carter Lake. We've had a lot of nice days and very little rain, so we've been busy as can be, he said. We've had a really nice spring. Over at Fox Run, Wakefield has noticed a new trend since the onset of the pandemic. We've been busy. We've seen a lot more couples come out. That's been a surprise, he said. It seems like for
It seems like every foursome, our husband and wives are not as many friends. There's been more couples coming out, which has been a big difference compared to any year or any place I've ever worked at. Clubhouse restrictions vary from course to course. At Shoreline, guests are asked to be cognizant of a 10-person limit, while Bentry will grant access to the clubhouse for patrons to use the restroom or pick up to-go food orders according to their website. Another common theme has been removing what Shoot calls touch point items. We've advised and have signage up for people to not touch flagsticks, and we've removed all of the rigs from bunkers, he said. We're washing range in a bleach solution and soap, along with spraying down all keys, carts, and all of that stuff. At Dodge Riverside, all rigs, ball washers, portable restrooms, and water coolers have been removed from the course. You can still order food and drink from their bar, but there's no indoor dining. Booking tee times online through the course website or via phone is the preferred method. Shoreline is operating all sales through a window in order to minimize the number of people in the pro shop and are allowing one person per cart unless they live in the same household. We're just rolling with all the CDC guidelines and what Gov Reynolds says. Shoot said. As restrictions get relaxed, some current policies may change. Wakefield says his course will soon start normalizing as guidelines change. We're about to turn the cups around here pretty soon, Wakefield said. We feel that if more and more restrictions are getting lifted, we do want to go back to normal. That will probably be one of the first things we change. To limit contact, courses are encouraging golfers to make tee items online or via phone. Each course has specific guidelines, most of which can be found on their website or by calling the course. Area coaches rely on social media creativity to instruct during COVID-19 by Patrick Donu. 1 minute on the clock. A made basket is worth 3 points. A miss subtracts 2 points from the score. Best overall tally wins. How about a different 1 minute challenge? Shooters must have 5 layups worth 5 free throws worth 2, then spending the remaining time making as many top of the key 3-pointers as possible. Best score wins. It may be the off season, but at Abraham Lincoln boys basketball coach Jason Isaacson is doing everything he can to bring some fun to any of his followers on Twitter looking to scratch their competitive basketball itch. Isaacson has posted a series of challenges that competitors of all ages can try at home as long as they have a basket, a ball, and a desire to improve. The current situation kind of spurned it, Isaacson said. You're just trying to put yourself in the kids' shoes, and hopefully if they've got a ball and a hoop, they can still get some work done. You don't have our gun and shooting machines and all that type of stuff, so you've just got to find a way to get it done. Typically, the spring is the time for basketball players to recoup, regroup, meet with coaches about the upcoming year, and get in the extra work during open gyms. Unfortunately, COVID-19 has prevented all that, but Isaacson, his staff, and many other coaches in the area from all sports are finding new ways to teach their athletes from afar. We're thinking of everything possible, Isaacson said. Our guys can kind of lead themselves through some Zoom weightlifting stuff. That's player led. You almost have to give it to them and hope they're getting it done. We've come up with some different leadership stuff. We give them assignments based on discipline and communication over some Google documents. We're also asking them to write down one game film from last year. Other high school athletes look to spring as a time to prepare for summer sports. However, that plan has been abandoned as well this year. Spring sports in Iowa were canceled on April 17th. Practice for the summer seasons of baseball and softball were originally scheduled to begin on May 4th, but at the moment there's uncertainty of when or if the season will begin. Iowa Gov Kim Reynolds said a decision on the status of summer sports will be updated by June 1st. Until a concrete decision has been made, area coaches are trying to prepare for the season under some unique guidelines. Iowa High School Athletic Association and Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union activities are in the midst of the prohibitive period of practice, competition, and sanctioned activity. No in-person contact between among coaches, administrators, and student athletes can take place. With those guidelines in place, Thomas Jefferson softball coach Amy Anderson has become creative. With the no practice man Monday, Anderson went around town delivering softball survival packs to her players. Social distancing measures were respected, and even though the encounter was atypical, it provided Anderson with a chance to see her players and enjoy fun moments together. Anderson also posted on social media optional hitting and conditioning drills her players can use to keep their skills sharp. Non-softball related activities are also implemented. We have done a Google Hangout with our players, Anderson said, just making sure the kids know they're on our minds a lot. We're still thinking about them and seeing how they're all doing. It gave them a chance to talk to us as coaches and to their teammates. I think it's hard on them not seeing their friends as much. It was just a fun hour spent being goofy, talking, and hanging out. Safety is the main concern. All coaches know that, and it's why they've been so dedicated to the new virtual reality that practices have become. And the reason for the dedication is quite simple. Sports can be a vital part of life. Basketball, that's part of my family too, as Isaacson said. It's been good for my family at home, but I'm really missing my other family too. Chris Doyle doesn't believe players should be rushed back by Steve Patterson. Safety and wellness of the participants should guide how a return to competition is structured for college football teams. As players train on their own and uncertainty remains surrounded when on-campus work will resume, Iowa strength and conditioning coordinator Chris Doyle said players should not be rushed back into game action. The steeper the curve as far as getting back to training, the more risk involved, Doyle said last week during a video conference. Doyle echoed Hawkeye coach Kirk Ferentz in suggesting that 8 weeks of preparation for strength and condition work and 4 for preseason practices is optimal. Ferentz said in video conference last month that 6 weeks is doable, but he is hopeful for 2 additional weeks as well. I remain hopeful that whenever they set the date for the start of the season, we'll have at least 8 weeks to try to get our team pulled together and some semblance of game readiness, Ferentz said. 4 weeks specifically for the strength and conditioning staff, and then 4 weeks more in football mode. But a return to competition and the day-to-day work preceding the point in time is only a part of the equation. Doyle said safety concerns include making certain that the weight rooms, locker rooms, and training areas remain clean to help prevent the spread of COVID-19, which has halted all team activities through college football since mid-March. We're going to need to address some things from a hygiene perspective, Doyle said. There will be some unique challenges there when you bring a number of guys into a locker room or a weight room. Doyle said a number of possible scenarios remain in the discussion stage, including the possibility of training taking place in a small group setting. Certainly, there will be janitorial staff available immediately upon completion of workouts, he said. We're going to need a really thorough plan, which we're currently working on. Sports medicine personnel and coaches are involved in conversations designed to play and return to training protocols. This is something we take very, very seriously, the safety and wellness of our athletes. That will be at the forefront of our minds as we plan and will certainly follow the directions of the experts in the medical community as to how we go about it, Doyle said. College administrators have discussed multiple scenarios for the upcoming season, including the possibilities of delaying start or shifting the entire 2020 schedule into a spring schedule beginning in February. Ferentz said during a video conference that he would see no problem with the late starting season running through late December. He had more concerns about plenty of questions
about a spring season that will be followed just months later by the regularly scheduled 2021 season. Doyle shares the concerns, included the absence of needed recovery time from the end of one season to the beginning of another. The challenges would exist there when you're looking at 18 to 22-year-old athletes playing to two full seasons in a very short window of time, Doyle said. That's concerning. Typically, we play 12, 13 games in a 12-month period. You're talking about doubling that. He said, cutting training time in half and doubling the exposure to competition only adds to potential risk. That is among areas of discussion as how the 2020 football season might be structure remains an unknown. Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren suggests Monday that the next 6 to 8 weeks will be paramount in determining if the season will begin on time in early September. There are some states opening up even as early as today, and we'll be watching closely. Warren said in an interview with the Big Ten Network, are the COVID-19 incidents, are they spiking or are they stable, are they going down? He said safely all involved parties will be at the core of any decision he makes, and conversations will include discussions and administrators, coaches, and student athletes will be a factor into the outcome. I think as we get into the early part of June, we'll be in a position that we'll be able to make tangible decisions, Warren said, adding that he preferred to avoid any speculation on possibilities. While a lot remains fluid, there are some knowns. The Big Ten on Monday announced an extension of its previous suspension of all organized teams, activities, and intercollegiate programs through June 1st because of concerns surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. The previous suspension, which prohibits everything from individual and small group workouts to full team activities, has been in place since March 13th and has now been extended twice. It is an additional measure to the previously announced cancellation of athletic competitions for the remainder of the current academic year and a moratorium on all on and off-campus recruiting activities. In a statement, the Big Ten indicates the suspension would be reevaluated on June 1st. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, May 8th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m., Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-408-4747. I'm Lauren. I'm from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. An article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles. But unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843-44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. The leaders chose the name Manna, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Manna, East Manna, West Manna, South Manna, High Manna, and Middle Manna. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Manna colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Manna, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Manna Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the village council of brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Manna colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Manna, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Manna colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Manna village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Manna colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Manna colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Manna socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Manna set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colony's Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family-style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the old order in 1932, the number of the society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.